an international meeting to decide a few things about the Libyan operation.
Like, who's going to pay for it? And who's going to stay the longest?
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for downloading the podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, March 29th. Coming up, home prices are still falling. What is the solution to ongoing housing market problems? Also, the Japanese government has some big decisions to make at Fukushima.
And what would you do with an aircraft carrier? We're going to answer that question and have some ideas, too, coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
In his speech last night, President Obama laid out what the mission is about in Libya, and he reiterated the U.S. actions there will be short-term and shared with other countries.
Because of this transition to a broader NATO-based coalition, the risk and costs of this operation to our military and to American taxpayers will be reduced significantly.
Meanwhile, today, representatives from more than 30 countries are meeting in London to discuss the coalition itself. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in London, and he joins us now. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
What are they meeting about?
Well, this is mainly a political meeting, keeping the coalition together, keeping everyone focused, and posing the question, after the conflict, what do we do with Gaddafi? Put him on trial or pack him off into retirement? Fundamentally, though, this summit is trying to look ahead and trying to prevent Libya after the conflict descending into the chaos that we saw in Iraq.
What about money? Is this about money too?
Not explicitly, but that is in the back of everyone's mind. This is where all this is headed. After the conflict, there's going to be a huge job of reconstruction, rebuilding damaged oil facilities and so on. Helping Libya get back onto its feet so it can start earning its living again is going to be very costly.
We heard the same story in the case of Iraq. And therefore, I fear that European states and even the United States, despite themselves, may find they're forced into a very costly undertaking.
Well, that was George Joffe of Cambridge University saying that people very often say at conferences like this, Libya is energy rich, it can surely support itself and pay for the damage itself. But as he says, that's what we heard with Iraq.
Yeah, and I know here in the U.S. we have lawmakers already expressing worries over cost. Who's going to pay for it all?
Well, this is the big question. As George Joffe suggests, the U.S. and Europe will probably wind up picking up some of the tab.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Steve.
Now let's get to this morning's news here in this country about home prices. We got the S&P Case-Shiller Index this morning, which found average prices at their lowest level in 11 years. Prices dropped in all of the 20 cities in the survey except Washington, D.C. Let's bring in Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So what do you make of these bad numbers this morning from Case-Shiller?
Of course, we keep in mind all housing data is seen in the rearview mirror, but still, this was unrelentingly horrible, and it's a huge drag on the economy. Now, the optimists were discounting the news, saying it's seasonal factors, bad weather, but bottom line, this is the sixth straight month we've seen sales and prices go down. Even new home sales are down 28% year over year. We're slumping our way into a double-dip housing recession here, and it's getting worse. There's no momentum for a turnaround. Inventory is still very high. Lenders still have big inventory of houses in various stages of foreclosure, and they haven't even put it on the market yet. And if you want a sense of impending doom, one in five homeowners have negative equity. And potential buyers out there, well, if prices are going lower, do you really want to jump in yet?
Julie, quickly, I mean, is there any solution to all of this problem in the housing market?
Well, their creative solutions by bankers have to come around right now. It's a little oxymoronic, but your choices are one, bulldoze and write off the assets, and they really don't want to do that, or rent, form a new real estate division. Renting, population is still growing. You've got rental shortage due to apartments being condominiumized, and you want to get the adult kids out of the basement and into their own places.
Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Today in Washington, FDIC regulators will be looking at just how prepared banks are for their possible demise. As part of financial reform, those banks deemed key to the nation's financial system will be required to write up what amounts to a living will, a way for the government to disassemble a big failed firm in an orderly way. Here's Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon.
Turning government regulators into banking undertakers isn't really all that far from the pitch in those heart-tugging funeral planning commercials. If our bank dies, can we cope?
We can help you hold things together, take care of a million things that must be done, and bring chaos into focus so you can cope.
The idea is regulators will be able to come in and break the company up in such a way as to minimize market disruption.
Bert Ely is a banking industry consultant. He says Congress has mandated that key financial institutions prove they can fail without the need for a bailout. If they can't, FDIC Chief Sheila Bair told the Reuters News Service,
then they should be downsized now. There is no reason in the world why they should get some kind of special treatment and backstop that other businesses in this country don't get.
Bert Ely is skeptical, though.
Any company directed to come up with a living will come up with something that, at least on paper, will seem plausible. You know, whether or not it's any good at a time of a crisis is another story.
Critics worry the plan won't cover what happens if big banks face collapse simultaneously. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Some numbers now. Spice maker McCormick says sales jumped 2% last quarter. That was all thanks, Steve, to consumers kicking their cooking up a notch in the U.S. and Asia, Europe and the Middle East.
Yeah.
They only wanted a dash of spice last quarter. Sales dropped 10% in those regions.
Bam! That's an Emerald of Dusty.
There you go.
Yeah, a little spice there. Home builder Lennar says it swung to a profit in the last quarter. Oil prices fell slightly to under $104 a barrel. The governor of Michigan signed off on that plan that would cut the number of weeks the unemployed there can get state benefits from 26 to 20 weeks.
If you're looking for more numbers, they're all at our website, marketplace.org.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, March 29th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson on Twitter as well, at Jeremy Hobson. Now, let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
Well, there's a push for the Japanese government to take temporary ownership of that badly damaged nuclear power plant. As a matter of fact, the whole company that owns the power plant, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company. And because of the loss of the power plant at Fukushima, the government wants to look at turning off the power to factories in Japan for short periods of time. The BBC's Mark Worthington is with us from Tokyo with the latest. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Steve.
How does the big industry feel about the possibility of having to limit power usage?
Well, interestingly, it's big business itself that's really floated this idea in the very first instance. Right now, many are having to deal with rolling blackouts. They do get advance warning, but it's quite unpredictable, and they're losing power for up to 3 hours at a time, and they're finding that very difficult to cope with.
Do we have any idea if a plan like this would work and how it would affect production?
The idea would be to limit power within a peak period, and it would obviously mean slowing production during that time. But what large factories would tell you would be that would be preferable to a total outage, which means they have to shut down the entire operation.
We're talking about Japan taking the extraordinary step of nationalizing TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, the owner of that nuclear plant at Fukushima. How would that work?
Well, what it would mean would be essentially a rescue by the government of a company who's seen its share price plummet since the disaster. What everyone is saying here, all the authorities, are that the company needs to be able to focus on dealing with the incident in Fukushima, not worrying about its own future. And that would be the idea behind it, to take hold of the company as a temporary measure to help it through this crisis.
And it would be just temporary, right?
That's all we're hearing at the moment, and something that the government doesn't want to dwell on when there's such a pressing crisis.
All right. The BBC's Mark Worthington in Tokyo. Mark, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
The Australian dollar today hit a near three-decade high against the U.S. dollar. In fact, today an Aussie dollar will buy you $1.03 in the U.S. From Sydney, the BBC's Phil Mercer reports.
The reason the Australian dollar is doing so well, China. Australia is rich with raw materials like iron ore and coal, and strong Chinese demand for those commodities has sent prices soaring, taking Australia's economy and the Australian dollar to new heights. Economist Shane Oliver is with AMP Capital Investors in Sydney. He says the currency shows no sign of slowing down just yet.
I think the Australian dollar is still a risky currency. It will still move up and down. It's just that global investors seem to have taken the view that the events of the last month, particularly in the Middle East and Japan, aren't enough to derail the global economies.
The good news for Australians is that a stronger currency makes it cheaper for the country to buy goods from abroad. But the strength in the currency also has downsides down under. The rising dollar makes trips here far more expensive, meaning Americans and others may visit less, hurting the country's key tourist industry. In Sydney, I'm the BBC's Phil Mercer for Marketplace.
Airlines have cut back short-haul routes by nearly a quarter in the past 5 years. Alex Goldmark reports now from station WNYC in New York. It's the business traveler who's feeling the biggest pinch.
Neil Shah used to fly a lot, 8 to 15 times a month as a management consultant. But he started to feel like it wasn't the best use of his time.
Getting to the airport, waiting in the security lines, you know, there was a potential for delay.
Shaving off 30 minutes may not matter much on a trip to Berlin, but it sure matters Boston to New York.
If all things were equal, my preference would be to fly. However, all of these other things have accumulated that make other means of travel just more convenient.
Scott Gibson is the head of ICF Skyworks, an airline advisory firm.
There are just fewer people flying in these short-haul markets.
Gibson gives the example of Kansas City to St. Louis. That route had as many as 30 flights a day in the late 90s. Now there are 9. A big part of the trend is fuel.
A lot of the fuel burn is in takeoff and landing. The airplane is really efficient when it's up high in the air. And so as fuel costs have gone up, it actually impacts short-haul flights as a percent of the airfare more than it impacts long-haul flying.
Plus, airports are charging carriers more per passenger. So one response has been to use bigger planes but fewer flights.
We actually reduced the number of flights, but we gained more seats.
John Happ is the president of the Texas Airports Council and a pilot. At his small Easterwood Field in College Station, there are about 10 flights a day, mostly to Dallas and Houston.
I see more and more corporate aircraft coming through than what we used to have.
That's because businessmen don't want to waste time waiting for the next flight, he says. And even Happ admits, the air schedules weren't convenient the last time he had a meeting in Dallas.
You know, if I had flown into Dallas, I'd have been there hours before my meeting, and I don't, you know, that time is valuable to me.
So the pilot drove 3 hours each way. In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, March 29th in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This week in Georgia, lawmakers will consider letting grocery stores sell alcohol on Sundays. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Gene Bonner reports.
When the bill was first introduced, some supporters argued that allowing retailers to sell alcohol on Sunday could boost state sales tax revenue. Kenneth Hagany is Georgia's fiscal economist. He says the bill would have scant impact on state revenues.
The state gets about $169 million in alcohol tax per year. If we got 2 to 3% additional, I think that would be $3 to $4 to $5 million per year of additional revenue.
Which is not a lot when you're dealing with an annual budget of $18 billion. Similarly, grocery stores likely wouldn't see a big bump in sales because shoppers won't necessarily buy more alcohol just because they can buy it on Sunday. Then there's shifting consumer habits. Many working parents, especially mothers, say Sunday is the only day they can shop for the week. Amy Hillman is one of those working moms.
That's the time I can leisurely go through the grocery store, plan the week ahead. And if part of that is we want to pick up a bottle of wine for a dinner party, I should be able to do that.
If Georgia passes the bill, it would leave just Indiana and Connecticut with a ban on retail alcohol sales on Sunday. In Atlanta, I'm Gene Bonner for Marketplace.
Some new terms now courtesy of Disney. Tangled. That's what we call Rapunzel now, Steve. Comes out on DVD today. And Rapunzel is the latest to join the Disney Princesses, which translates roughly to a big money brand for Disney.
Welcome to the wonderful world of Disney Princess, where happily ever after happens every day.
Well, that brand is the subject...
I love that. It's really nice.
Well, it's the subject, this Disney Princess brand, of a new book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter. The author is Peggy Orenstein, and she's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first of all, when I was growing up, Disney princesses didn't even exist. Now it's apparently a $4 billion business. How did that happen?
It was one guy's idea. His name is Andy Mooney, and he went to an ice show in Philadelphia, and he saw a bunch of little girls dressed as princesses, and horrors, they were wearing homemade costumes that they had developed with their imaginations. That had to be stopped. That had to be licensed. And the first year that they put them out there, it was $300 million. And by 2009, yeah, we've hit a $4 billion a year business.
And does Disney have a lot of competitors here in trying to corner the princess market?
So they started this market, and then everybody else thought, "Woo, pink is the new gold," and they jumped on board. So now whether you're looking at like the guy who's selling a T-shirt on Etsy that's pink with a crown on it and says, "Give me the credit card and nobody gets hurt," or Mattel or McDonald's, or, you know, basically anything that can be pink and a crown slapped on it has been turned pink and a crown slapped on it.
All right. Now, when you think about all of the characters that little girls look up to and want to be like, I would think princesses would be like the least bad. But as you write, that's really not the case.
What happens with the princess culture is that it goes from being this sort of sweet, innocent, wand-waving thing to being about being the princess diva and the makeup, and the culture is telling them and encouraging them to define themselves from the outside in.
What would you say to parents who are listening to this and wondering whether they should be buying their daughters the Ariel and Belle gear that they see all over the TV and in the stores?
You can't keep the commercial ideas about femininity and the sexualization of girlhood out entirely. So your job is not to lock your daughter in a tower. Your job is to, when she's little, limit the choices. And that lays the groundwork so that as she grows older, you can really help her navigate through all of this to a true happily ever after.
Peggy Orenstein, author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And there's more about the book at our big book blog at marketplace.org. And by the way, Steve, this movie Tangled that comes out on DVD today, it cost $260 million for Disney to make. That is the second most expensive film to make in history. And
it's a cartoon.
It's a cartoon. A lot of hair, though.
And a lot of hair.
And you know how much it's made, Disney?
Oh, I can't imagine.
$600 million so far.
My goodness. My goodness. And finally this morning, Jeremy, what would you do with an aircraft carrier?
Nobody's ever asked me that.
No, and probably never will again. Yeah. The British government is taking bids for one of its decommissioned ships. A way to make a little money in these budget-slashing
days.
They
want to sell an aircraft carrier?
They do. They're selling it online, as a matter of fact. Wow. Bidders on the ship are being asked to announce what they would do with it upon purchase. And so we've gotten
not
some...
Not attack Britain. That would be a good way to make sure you get your name high on the list.
We've been soliciting some comments on our website, and we ask you to do the same, by the way, marketplace.org. Share your thoughts with us about what you would do with an aircraft carrier. Here are some of the thoughts of our listeners so far this morning. New York City 6th Borough. You lived in New York City, huh? You can just pull the ship up Hudson
true.
River.
Put it right on the west side. Yeah.
Absolutely. Scrap metal.
So, that'd be a waste.
Yeah, it would be a waste of a big ship. Go pirate hunting. So there you go.
Put it right off of the Somalia. Coast of Somalia.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, very good.
Maybe it could be used for a go-kart track or skateboard park for the rich.
Just what the rich need.
I think, you know, this is what I came up with earlier, Jeremy. I think
idea?
A giant stage for the big Hall & Oates reunion concert that has yet to be announced, and probably never will be announced, at Cleveland's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I think, right, we just found a I think we just found a buyer for the aircraft carrier. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.